Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
$2 billion on the presidential election, hardly a mumbling word about poverty, hardly a mumbling word about the prison industrial complex, hardly a mumbling word about the new Jim Crow.
Coming up, we'll hear from religious scholar and activist Cornel West, who spoke at a recent Chicago area event.
We girls join the ghostly procession, carefully stepping over the dead and dying.
And we'll hear from a survivor of the bombing of Hiroshima who spoke at a recent Chicago conference opposing the nuclear age. But first, here are some headlines from the Indie Media Network around the world with Mitchell Stepinchik.
Argentina Indie Media featured grassroots protests against the installation of a major U.S. conglomerate in a town in central Argentina. On January 29, 2013, the town of Malvinas Argentinas in the Córdoba province in central Argentina saw the establishment of a plant owned by the U.S.-based company Monsanto. The same day, more than 400 people marched in protest, demanding that the very forces of earth and life not be subjugated to the profit demands of an international conglomerate. A translation from one dispatch read in part, quote, "We ask for a different life project. We do not want more loss of life, no more violence to our people caused by an international killer," unquote. Monsanto has faced worldwide criticism and protest for years over health concerns related to its genetically modified food products, efforts to undermine organic agriculture, control of food and seed stocks, and efforts to hide such information from consumers, including blocking efforts at product labeling. Argentina Indie Media also reported that a judge did grant a temporary injunction against Monsanto, blocking the pending operation of the plant until an environmental impact assessment has been completed. Indie Media UK posted a feature headlined "Court Report on Baton Use at Student Demonstrations," with the subheadline, "A police commander has described his officers as, quote, superbly restrained," unquote, after watching video footage of them striking down at protesters' heads with batons during a student demonstration. Quoting from the feature dated February 16, 2013, "Bronze Commander Woods, who is giving evidence at the trial of Alfie Meadows and Zach King for violent disorder at Woolwich Crown Court, had earlier said that baton should only be used as an absolute last resort, and that officers are made aware of the potential for injury or death from a strike to the head. Woods was responsible for policing in Parliament Square during the student protests on December 9, 2010, that left Meadows with a life-threatening head injury following a baton strike to the head. After watching a video of officers striking out at protesters, some with bandanas around their faces, as they slowly jostled past, Wood said, I believe the officers were incredibly restrained, superbly restrained. I'm with them all the way. You have protesters masked up. The footage was filmed by police evidence gatherers as thousands of students demonstrated against the rise in tuition fees that was to be voted on in Parliament later that day. Los Angeles Indie Media reported of a clever Occupy Connected protest at a noted annual parade. Quoting from the feature dated January 2, 2013, Occupy Fights Foreclosure, or OFF, a subgroup of Occupy LA, continues to fight against illegal foreclosures that are currently widespread in the state of California. OFF started the year 2013 by marching and chanting at the annual Tournament of Roses parade in Pasadena. The group of activists and victims of illegal foreclosures met at Singer Park on January 1st at 6 a.m. Tuesday morning to prepare for the parade. They adjusted a 15-foot-high float with a giant puppet rendering of Rich Uncle Pennybags from the board game Monopoly on a wagon and marched the 5-mile route following the parade. Spokesperson Carlos Marroquin said that the reason for marching at the Rose Parade is not only to protest illegal foreclosure practices of the major banks, but also to create public awareness and spread the word about banks' fraudulent actions. Austin Indie Media featured a story about Texas police committing a roadside rape against two women. Quoting from the feature dated January 7, 2013, two Texas women are suing after state troopers subjected them to a humiliating and invasive roadside body cavity search that was caught on video. Female trooper Kelly Hallison is seen in the footage aggressively searching the genitalia of Angel Dobbs, 38, and her niece Ashley Dobbs, 24, in front of passing cars. The women, who claimed the trooper used the same rubber glove for both of them, were initially stopped by Hallison's colleague David Farrell on State Highway 161 near Irving after he saw one of them throw a cigarette butt out the window. Angel Dobbs said Hallison irritated a cyst she suffers from, causing severe and continuing pain and discomfort. The suit said that Angel Dobbs was overwhelmed with emotion and a feeling of helplessness and reacted, stating that Hallison had just violated her in a most horrific manner. The two women are also suing the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Stephen McCraw, whom they claim ignored previous complaints about unlawful strip searches, cavity searches, and the like. The Dobbs' lawyer, Scott H. Palmer, said this shocking incident, which was filmed on one of the trooper's dash-mounted cameras, was a roadside sexual assault. He said the Texas Rangers investigated his client's complaints but failed to take any action against the troopers. "You can see what's happening clearly," Palmer told the Dallas Morning News of the video. "No one's ever seen the likes of this. We can't let them get away with it," unquote. Boston Indy Media featured a report saying that all charges against all remaining Occupy Boston activists have been dropped. Quoting from the feature dated February 11, 2013, "On Friday, February 8, 2013, Suffolk County prosecutors decided to drop all pending criminal charges against all remaining Occupy Boston activists awaiting trial as a result of the mass police arrests in October and December 2011. This action amounts to an implicit acknowledgement of the unconstitutionality of the arrests and criminal charges brought against almost 200 Occupy Boston participants. By declining to pursue charges further, the state has finally admitted that the demonstrations by Occupy activists were legal and constitutionally protected activities. This decision, which comes after more than 14 months of delay and evacuation, is evidence of both the legality and the necessity of movements such as Occupy." Chicago Indy Media featured recent developments by Southside Chicago Youth to establish a Southside Trauma Center. Quoting from the feature dated February 6, 2013, "For years, activists with the Chicago Southside group Fearless Leading by the Youth, abbreviated FLY, have pressured the Chicago establishment, particularly the University of Chicago, to reestablish one or more adult trauma centers on Chicago Southside, where there are currently no adult trauma centers. FLY has been particularly active on this issue ever since one of their members died, in part because he could not be sent to a trauma center quickly enough. FLY staged a protest outside the new University of Chicago Hospital near 57th Street and Maryland Avenue in Hyde Park, which saw four people arrested. The university nevertheless spent $700 million on the Center for Care and Discovery and has continued to rebuff demands for a Southside Trauma Center. The arrests have spurred many follow-up actions, including a petition, a vigil, and a call-in day of action on February 6th.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indy Media website at chicago.indymedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
I pledge allegiance to the United States of Conscious Uprising and the Republic for which it stands. Destruction of sterilized mendacity recorded for our children. To the anals of memory in your body. To the structure of justice and the rhythm of love. I pledge allegiance to making love. Creativity's invitation to celebrate. I pledge allegiance to uprising. Rise up. Rise up.
Cornel West is a prominent academic, activist, and radio show host. He's the co-host with Tavis Smiley of the weekly radio show Smiley and West, which was aired on WBEZ, Chicago's NPR affiliate, until October 2012. The show was deemed too advocacy on the issue of poverty in America and was pulled from the station's schedule. But Chicago media activists launched a firestorm of controversy in response. One of the consequences from that firestorm was a Chicago event entitled Poverty, Power, and the Public Airwaves, which included Cornel West in person. We'll now hear the presentation given by Cornel West, which was held at Northwestern University Law School on November 9, 2012.
My dear brother Tavis Smiley, I've been together now for 25 years. I take a bullet, not in my hand, but in my heart. I love him that much, respect him that deeply. Thank each and every one of you for coming out tonight. I won't take too much time. We won't call in response. That's my tradition. Antiphonal activity back and forth. But my dear sister ended with Mamie Teal, and that moves me deeply. Because Amy Teal, she stepped in the lectern at Robert Temple's Church of God in Christ here in Chicago in August 1955. You all recall what she said. I don't have a minute to hate. I will pursue justice for the rest of my life. That's Mamie Teal. And that's the tradition that produced me. That's why when I come to Chicago, I think of the love train that Curtis Mayfield was singing about. People get ready. Are you ready to get on the train? That's why I gave Brother Lupe a hug, and that's why I love Brother Ali so much, because the artists are not ornamental or decorative. They're constitutive and integral to who we are. If you're really on the love train, if you really have courage to tell the truth and bear witness, and you're not afraid to die, if you're willing to connect with a tradition that's bigger than you, that's why it's serious talk. You see? That last line of Percy Shelley's great pamphlet of 1821, it was a revolutionary pamphlet. What did he say, my dear sister Tillman? I love you so much. What did Shelley say? He said, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. I want to say that here at the law school. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And by poets, he didn't mean versifiers. He meant all of those who have the courage to use their imagination and empathy to conceive of a world that's better than one where there's too many wretched of the earth, be it in Asia, Africa, Latin America, or the south side of Chicago. And that every law that you enact already presupposes a certain vision of what the world is. So if your world is confined to the status quo, it's going to be truncated legislation. And so when we talk about public airways, we raise the question of public life. Why is it that our public life is so impoverished and so vacuous? It's not just public airways, it's public education. Look at the vicious attack on our precious young people with privatized education. Thank God for Sister Lewis, wherever she is. Thank God for the union. No, let's tell the truth. How you gonna have 685 schools and 202 nurses for those precious children? 684 schools and 1 out of 4 even have arts, and we wonder why they can't play instruments like Lakeside or watch 103rd Street Rhythm Band. Public life is so thin in our society. The very bonds that connect us as citizens, not consumers, as human beings concerned about the quality of common good. John Dewey is right. Show me a democracy that has an impoverished public life, and I'll show you one that is dominated by oligarchs and plutocrats driven by profit maximization that will do anything in order to get over and obsess only with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Oh, yes. Gangster activity is what it is. Scandal after scandal after scandal. And when you get caught, you pay money. You don't go to jail. So let's put this in perspective in light of our poets. Not just the versifiers, not just the musicians. All human beings who conceive of a better world and refuse to defer to the status quo the way it is. And it is a love train. What I like about the three of us,
all three of us are on the love train. Oh, yeah. And when you really love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. When you really love folk, you loathe the fact they're being treated unfairly. And if you don't say something, the rocks are going to shout out. Oh, yes, it's fire in your bones. You've got to feel it. It's not just an abstract sensibility. It's a choice that you make to say, this is the way I want to live my life. Reverend Hatch knows what I'm talking about. Love your brother. And we need more of it. Why? Because let's be honest about it. We live in a society where everything's up for sale. Everybody's up for sale. Who's talking about integrity? Who's talking about constancy? Who's talking about trying to conceive of another world and be willing to go down swinging like Ella Fitzgerald or Muhammad Ali? And that's what's so sad about the present situation. I'm glad about the fact that we fought against a right-wing takeover of the White House. That's important. But the problem is, our politicians, including our dear brother Barack Obama, still has a conservative mentality when it comes to obsession with austerity, austerity. What you gonna cut? What you gonna cut? What you mean, what you gonna cut? Start with the prison industrial complex. How come you find money for that all the time? Money, money, money for the prison industrial complex. When you gonna cut that? You found $1 trillion. Gator, you know what I'm talking about. You found $1 trillion in the last 27 years for the prison industrial complex. But when it comes to quality education, quality housing, my dear brother fighting the struggle right there, the Henderson's here in Chicago. When it comes to quality jobs with a living wage, I'm not talking about low-wage jobs. I'm talking about wages where you can feed your family with dignity and decency. You can't find a penny. But let's go to the military industrial complex. Oh, you got money for those smart drones, don't you? Dropping bombs on innocent people. It's about 3,500 now. It's a war crime. That's what it is. You talked about Nagasaki. That's a war crime. Hiroshima, that's a war crime. You don't kill innocent folk. Bin Laden's a gangster. If you're in war against him, okay, maybe, but don't kill his daughter. That's why Emmett Till's mother is so cruel. She could have stepped to that lectern and said, you know what? I'm tired of all these white folk who are silent when it comes to American terrorism called Jim and Jane Crow. Why don't we just start arbitrarily killing some folk? No, she said no. She knew George Bernard Shaw's right. Hatred is the coward's revenge against those who intimidate you. Hatred's always cowardly. She refused to be a coward. She's going to take a high ground, but she was still going to tell the truth. And part of the problem of our public airway, think of it, the $6 billion spent on the election. $2 billion on the presidential election, hardly a mumbling word about poverty, hardly a mumbling word about the prison industrial complex, hardly a mumbling word about the new Jim Crow, hardly a mumbling word about the trade unions dealing with declining, stagnating wages, with the profits still exponentially growing on the oligarchic greed and plutocratic greed. What kind of public debate did we have? We just had an election. Where's the discussion? Where's the substance? Where's the content? What about the precious children? America is 34 on the top 35 nations of industrial societies when it comes to child poverty. Ahead only Romania. I love Romanians, but they're not on the cutting edge of the struggle for justice. 34 out of 35. Did you hear any serious discussion, public discussion about child poverty? You think Marion Wright Edelman been living for nothing? You think Martin Luther King Jr. and Fannie Lou Hamer died talking about poverty for nothing? Then how come we can't even raise the issue? Why? Because it's truncated, it's suffocated by the oligarchic and plutocratic interests. And that's just not big words. We're talking about big money, big corporation, big banks. Big banks now get 42% of all the profits in America. That's called the financialization of monopoly capitalism. Or it's another way of saying bankers are not accountable.
That's why they can engage in criminal activity like insider trading, market manipulation, and predatory lending, and not one of them persecuted, investigated, not one go to jail. Let Jamal get caught on the corner south side of Chicago, he going straight to jail, quick. Bring some of his partners too. How long can we put up with it? How long are we going to put up with it? That's what we're talking about today. We're at that precipice. The relation between the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, Wall Street oligarchy complex, and then the corporate media multiplex. Fox News. PowerPoints of the conservative version of oligarchic rule in the country, called the Republican Party. They're in deep trouble. They've got some xenophobic challenges. MSNBC, PowerPoints of the Obama administration. Very colorful. Oh, they got colorful faces on there now. I love each and every one of them. I'm a Christian. I love everybody. You know that, Father Flager. People got upset. I called the president a black mascot of Wall Street oligarchs. I'm a Christian. I love mascots. But when you bail out banks, now to the tune of $16 trillion, but refuse to bail out homeowners, or when you bail out your workers, you can brag about bailing out your workers, but how come they had to change their contracts, deal with lower wages, deal with layoffs, but Wall Street didn't have their contracts touched so that the compensation for executives continue to be obscene and profane, and nobody could raise a mumbling word in the corporate truncated multiplex. Thank God for Amy Goodman. Thank God for Tavis Smiley on television. That's true. It's true. And there's no way we will ever be able to reinvigorate and rejuvenate our public life unless we have what Socrates had. You turn to line 24A in Plato's Apology. Right before he was putting him to death, condemning him to death, he stood there before the jury. He said, "Parisia is the cause of my unpopularity." And parisia is fearless speech, plain speech, frank speech, unintimidated speech, telling the truth whatever the price is, trying to tell the truth and allowing the suffering to speak, acknowledging you're fallible, but at the same time knowing that there's too much mendacity and lying going on in the corporate truncated multiplex. Or even a Christian like myself, Jesus crucified. Why? Because when he went to Jerusalem, he went straight to the temple. And what did he do in that temple? He ran out the money changers. And the temple at that time was a combination of Wall Street, Hollywood, recording, video, radio industry, and White House, Congress, State House, and City Hall. Talking about you, Brother Rahm. Yeah, that's right. I'm talking about you. That's right. That's right. Yes, that's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't hate individuals. I hate injustice. I don't care what color they are. I don't care what religion or non-religion they have. It's a matter of trying to be honest and to make sure people are accountable, answerable, and responsible, especially when it comes to the least of these, especially when it comes to the orphan and the widow and the fatherless and the motherless and the poor, gay brothers, lesbians, sisters, bisexual, black, brown. Let us never forget our precious indigenous brothers and sisters. 1492, World War I started. It's still going on right now. I'm going to talk about it if I'm the last brother in the country that does. They're my brothers and sisters, too. Brother Danny knows what I'm talking about. Oh, yeah. And that's a tradition that's open to all of us, no matter what color we are. It's the choices that we make. Oh, we're going to be so seduced and tempted by the monies dangled, the status and wealth offered. Or are we going to be
on our way to the grave. So when the worms get us and start finally getting to our bodies, they'll say, this person was on fire for something bigger than just the ground and the worms. It was about love. It was about justice. Yes, justice is what love looks like in public, but any justice that is only justice soon degenerates into something less than justice. You're going to need the love supreme that John Coltrane was talking about if we're going to seriously expand the public airways, because we need vision, we need organizing, mobilizing, love at the center of it, open across race, across sexual orientation, across ethnicity, yes, even across class. But we're looking at the world from the vantage point of those Malcolm X said, catching hell. And some of us going to go down fighting to ensure that their humanity is always affirmed. Thank you all.
That was Cornel West speaking in Chicago on November 9th, 2012. If you'd like to hear the full audio of the question and answer session, as well as other presentations that evening, visit the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Baby blinks her eye, the sun falls from the sky. She feels the sting of a thousand fires as the city around her dies. Some sleep beneath the rubble, some wake to a different world. A crying babe will become a laughing girl.
On December 2, 1942, scientists on the campus of the University of Chicago generated the very first sustaining controlled chain reaction of nuclear energy, launching the age of nuclear energy and of nuclear weapons. 70 years later, on the weekend of December 1st and 2nd, 2012, the University of Chicago played host to a conference entitled A Mountain of Waste, 70 Years High, Ending the Nuclear Age Conference, which gathered anti-nuclear activists and health professionals from around the world. One of the featured speakers was Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the nuclear bomb drop on Hiroshima, Japan, in World War II. This is Setsuko Thurlow's presentation at that conference.
I am grateful to be with you today to observe this significant day, anniversary of Dr. Enrico Fermi and his team's successful experiment. I have read much about the work of Dr. Fermi and his team, but I have never dreamt that one day I would actually be here. My mind and heart is filled with awe and pain. Nevertheless, it is very significant that this conference provides us an opportunity to ponder the meaning of living in nuclear age. Listening to all of you yesterday and today, I am so deeply moved by your passionate, energetic attempt to share and learn from each other. Thank you for that inspiration. I would like to share with you my experience of atomic bombing of Hiroshima and some thoughts related to it. In the spring of 1945, after the U.S. capture of island of Tinian and Saipan in the South Pacific, carpet bombing of Dresden and Covenant in Europe were transferred to Japan. Starting with the massive air raids of Tokyo by hundreds of B-29 Super Fortress bombers, with over 100,000 casualties overnight, approximately 70% of major cities of Japan were already incinerated. My hometown of Hiroshima was ranked the 10th largest city at that time, but was spared from the ongoing raids, although daily and nightly reconnaissance flights kept us sleepless and ready to run to shelter in the darkened city. People's anxiety grew by the day, wondering, why not us? Little did we know that Hiroshima had been already selected for target and was deliberately kept intact to assess the effects of a new type of weapon. The target was set as military installation surrounded by people's residences. Thus, the inclusion of citizens in the indiscriminate attack was in the original plan. This was one of the recommendations made by the interim committee to the President Truman. On August 6, 1945, I was a 13-year-old grade 8 student in the student mobilization program. I was with about 30 other girls working at the Army headquarters as a decoding assistant. The building was 1.8 kilometer, 1 mile from the hypocenter. The morning began at 8 a.m. with a briefing and pep talk. Major Yanai said, girls, you've been trained perfectly for this job. Prove your patriotic spirit for the emperor's sake. Yes, sir, we will. At that moment, I saw the bluish-white flash outside the window. I remember having the sensation of floating in the air. The building was collapsing, and my body was thrown up in the air. As I regained consciousness in the silence and in the total darkness, I found myself pinned by the ruins of the collapsed building. I could not move. I knew I was faced with death. I began to hear my classmates' cries, "Mother, help me. God, help me." Then suddenly, I felt hand touching my left shoulder from behind and heard the man's voice saying, "Don't give up. Keep pushing. Keep moving. I'm trying to free you." See the light coming through that opening. Crawl towards it and get out of this place as quickly as possible. By the time I came out, the ruins were already on fire. That meant about 30 girls who were with me in the same room were burned to death alive. A soldier ordered me and two other girls, surviving girls, to escape to the nearby hill. I looked around. Although it was morning, It was dark as twilight, with dust and smoke rising in the air. I saw streams of ghostly figures slowly shuffling from the center of the city toward the nearby hills. They were naked and tattered, bleeding, burned, blackened, and swollen. Part of their bodies were missing, flesh and skin hanging from their bones, some with their eyeballs hanging in their hands, and some with their stomachs burst open with intestines hanging out. We girls joined the ghostly procession, carefully stepping over the dead and dying. There was a deathly silence, broken only by the moans of the injured and their plea for water. The foul stench of burnt skin and flesh filled the air. At the foot of the hill was an army training ground about the size of 2 football fields. It was covered with the dead and injured who were desperately begging, often in faint whispers, "Water, water, please, please give me water." But we had no containers to carry water. We went to a nearby stream to wash off the blood and dirt from our bodies. Then we tore off our blouses, soaked them with water, and hurried back to hold them to the mouth of the injured, who desperately sucked in moisture. We kept busy at this task all day. We did not see any doctors or nurses. When darkness fell, we sat on the hillside and all night watched the entire city burn. Numbed by the massive and grotesque scale of death and suffering we had witnessed. The following day, my parents came in search of me. My father had been out of town, and my mother was rescued out of our collapsed house. But my sister and her 4-year-old son were crossing the bridge to go to the doctor at the moment of detonation, and were burned, blackened, and swollen beyond recognition. We could identify my sister only by her voice and the unique hairpins she wore in her hair. We escaped to a relative's damaged summer house on the hill, where we cared for them for several days without food nor medicine until death released them from their agony. Their bodies were thrown into the ditches dug out by soldiers, covered with gasoline, and set on fire. Soldiers kept turning the bodies, uttering, "Stomach is not quite burned yet, and head is half burned." My parents and I stood there, emotionless, tearless, and speechless. It was the most grotesque cremation, totally devoid of human dignity and respect. This memory of my inability to act normally, like shedding tears, troubled me for many years. Until I went to university and studied the human behavior in the ultimate condition. Dr. Lifton of Harvard called this phenomena psychic numbing, paralysis of the mind, which practically all of the survivors experienced. In the center of the city, my own age group of over 8,000 grade 7 and 8 students from all the high schools in the city were engaged in the task of clearing fire lanes. My sister-in-law was there as a supervising teacher. Many of them were simply vaporized instantly by the heat of 4,000 degrees Celsius. We never found the body of my sister-in-law. Radiation, as you all know, the unique characteristic of atomic bombing, affected people in mysterious and random ways, with some dying immediately and others weeks, months, or years later by the delayed effects. And the radiation is still killing survivors today, 67 years later. My uncle and aunt survived the bombing without any apparent physical injury. But then, about a week later, they started feeling very sick and started developing purple spots all over their bodies. My mother noted that their internal organs seemed to be rotting and were coming out as a thick black fluid. In those days, the first thing we did in the morning was to check every corner of our bodies to make sure there was no purple spot indicating imminent death. Thus, my beloved city of Hiroshima suddenly became desolation, with heaps of ash and rubble, skeletons and blackened corpses. Its population of 360,000, most of whom were non-combatant women, children, and elderly, became victims of the indiscriminate massacre of atomic bombing. By the end of 1945, approximately 140,000, and as of present day, approximately 260,000 have perished because of the effects of the blast, heat, and radiation. Following Japan's surrender, General MacArthur governed Japan as the supreme commander of the Allied forces and introduced some needed and beneficial reforms in education, agriculture, women's social and political rights, labor unions, corporate structure, and so forth. Demilitarization and democratization was his main goals. Within days, however, the U.S. occupation authorities imposed a press code in order to censor and even confiscate any newspaper and magazine articles on the topic of survivors' suffering. The occupation authorities confiscated diaries people kept, poems, photographs, medical specimens, slides for microscopes, and doctor's treatment records, or some 32,000 items in all. Informing the world of the American scientific and engineering triumph was acceptable. But describing the suffering of survivors was not. Because of this politically oppressive and hostile milieu, survivors were deprived of the normal process of grieving following their massive trauma and had to repress their suffering in silence and isolation. An additional injury to the psyche of the survivors was caused by the American establishment of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Its mandate was solely to study the effects of radiation upon human beings, but not to offer treatment, even though tens of thousands were suffering from inadequate medical care. The ABCC did not even share its findings with Japanese doctors who were trying to deal with the new and unknown medical problems. With the return of the full sovereignty to Japan in 1952, a flood of political, scientific, medical, and historical information suddenly became available, enabling journalists, researchers, and scholars for the first time to see the experience of survivors in historical perspective and global context. Gradually, they came to be aware that the main motive for the atomic bombing was political rather than military, to impress the Soviet Union and to force Japan to surrender before the Soviet Union could enter the war. They did not see it as a military necessity, as stated by a well-known American myth that bombs shortened the war. These points were supported by the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, as well as the views of other generals like General Eisenhower and several others, I can't remember their names, and later by historians. The survivors saw themselves not as sacrifice on the altar of peace, but as a pawn in the opening move of Cold War. Some survivors were able to conceptualize and articulate the meaning of nuclear weapon as a threat to planetary survival. This ability enabled them to transcend their own personal tragedies and to become committed to the mission of warning the world of the danger of nuclear age. They were convinced that humanity and nuclear weapon could not coexist, and that no human being should ever have to repeat our experience of the inhumanity, illegality, immorality, and cruelty of atomic bomb. These visionary survivors empowered other survivors to become activated and to be the core of Japan's powerful peace movement. That's the end of my written speech. So I will. Thank you. I think I have some time. I'd like to just speak. Can I?
Yes.
Do I have time?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just talk this time. In 1954, well, I finished university in Hiroshima, and I came to Virginia, your country, on scholarship. And within a couple of days, I was interviewed by the press, and I was asked to talk about my feeling about what was happening in the South Pacific and in Japan. This is about the testing of the biggest hydrogen bomb at the Bikini Atoll. You know about the total chaos at that time. That was April 1945. August of that year, I came to United States. And I was rather naive, fresh out of college, and I honestly shared my opinion that continuing testing in the South Pacific was doing more harm to humans and animal environment, and Japanese were suffering from lack of sushi and sashimi and all that. Anyway, I gave critical opinion about U.S. testing. And lo and behold, following day, I started receiving unsigned hate letters. They said, we Japanese deserve that because we were sneaky at the Pearl Harbor. And those bombs did a good job. They are good bombs. Those things were the content of the letter. I was frightened. Within the few days of being in the United States, this was the welcome I received. I had to think. I had to do soul searching. What do I do? Do I put the zipper over my mouth and pretend I know nothing about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Oh, Bikini. It was a very traumatic week for me, but I was able to come out of that experience with stronger commitment that it is my responsibility to share my memories of what we experienced. I was very disturbed to see many young people just echoing President's narrative. Bombs were necessary. The war had to be ending as quickly as possible. I felt people were not giving any serious thought. There was no serious thought, no moral sense, just it was okay. It was good bombs. I think that idea of good bombs deeply penetrated into the psyche of American people. And I think that influenced your government, a continuing development of the weapons and rushing into the nuclear arms race. There is definitely relationship between the justification of Hiroshima Nagasaki and the later development of nuclear weapons. Well, I couldn't go back home. I just arrived. How do I live? I have to study. I have to know more about the meaning of what I experienced in Hiroshima. So I desperately started reading, and one person's writing, which really helped me greatly, was Professor Richard Falk, international law specialist at the Princeton University. And that really helped me to organize my thoughts in a legal, moral way. And I want to share that with you. 5 minutes? Okay. 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 He said this: the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were viewed as contribution to the ending of the popular and just war. Therefore, they have never been appraised in the necessary way as atrocities. They have never been understood as they certainly would have been understood had Hiroshima and Nagasaki been located in an allied country. Somehow, we've got to create that awareness so that Hiroshima is understood to have been on the same level of depravity and in many ways far more dangerous to us as a species and as a civilization than was even Auschwitz. This kind of writing he does, that was a tremendous help. Now, after a year in Virginia, I went to University of Toronto in Canada, and I saw different culture, different people. They view the nuclear issues belong to Americans and Japanese, not to them. Without realizing, the Canadian scientists were involved in the Manhattan Project, and it was the Canadian uranium which was used for the bomb which exploded above me. And the Prime Minister of Canada wrote in his diary that he was glad it was used on Japanese, not on the white race of Europe.
Shame,
yes. They didn't know. I had to tell them, and that shocked them. But anyway, it's interesting. The same thing hit their different perspectives about the nuclear age. The people's perspective in Japan, in the United States, and the Canadian. Canadian feel it's the problem between United States and Japan, not to realize it was a universal problem. This is a problem which applies to everyone on the planet.
That was Hiroshima bombing survivor Setsuko Thurlow, who spoke in Chicago in December 2012. More presentations from the conference are available from the website Radio for All, which is linked from Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indiemedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Rita Sand and the staff of CanTV for audio assistance. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode From the Trenches.